From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Strike two, the U.S. bombs Iraq again. We'll have a debate on the missile attack and sanctions. Kids are back to school. We look at the funding crisis in public education and talk to a New Jersey activist who begins a fast tomorrow protesting education cuts.
I mean, in many ways, it almost seems as if the system is now functioning in such a way, both the education system and the economic system, to produce a class of urban untouchable. You know, kids who come out of these high schools with no skills, with no opportunities, and inevitably many of them turn to crime and ultimately will go on to jail and become part of the permanent underclass.
And a conversation with Winona LaDuke, Ralph Nader's vice presidential running mate on the Green Party ticket. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now!, Public Broadcasting's only daily election show. I'm Amy Goodman.
To Saddam Hussein. When you abuse your own people or threaten your neighbors, you must pay a price.
And will not be shaken by the winds of evil.
Inshallah.
God willing. God will be our ally.
And I trust this is the beginning of decisive action to limit the power and arrogance of Saddam Hussein.
Yes, the U.S. has launched a second missile attack on southern Iraq last night in what the Pentagon has called a mop-up operation. According to U.S. officials, the mission was intended to destroy Iraq's ability to attack aircraft, enforcing an expanded no-fly zone. Meanwhile, the U.N. Security Council has renewed economic sanctions against Iraq. Joining us now to debate the U.S. missile attack on Iraq and the renewal of sanctions are two people. Daniel Pipes joins us from Philadelphia. He is editor of the Middle East Journal and with the Middle East Forum. And we're also joined by Dr. Nasser Arouri, and he is professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts. I wanted to begin with Daniel Pipes, your reaction to what has gone on over the last few days, both the missile attack, the first, and the second last night.
I think it's the appropriate thing to do. I don't think we've been consistent enough, and therefore Saddam Hussein keeps on tempting us, trying to find out how far he can go, and we have to slap him down. I think if we'd been a bit more resolute over the years, he probably wouldn't make these efforts. He wouldn't be challenging us in the way he does. But I welcome it. I think it's the right thing to do.
Let's get the reaction of Dr. Arouri. Dr. Arouri, your reaction to the missile attacks, both number one and number two.
Well, I wasn't really surprised. I think that knowing that there are a lot of factors here, short term as well as long term, I was not really surprised that there was a strike. I mean, in the short term, I think this is intended to extend American hegemony in the area. I think it is intended to show a force of strength. It's intended to improve President Clinton's chances in the elections and to provide him with a tough image. And I think it is also intended to tell the world and to tell the Arabs in the region that we mean business. What we say goes in the Middle East. These are the short-term objectives.
What do you think the long-term objectives are?
I think the long-term objective really has to do with the dual containment policy that's been in effect since the Bush administration. That is to say, to contain Iraq and Iran by striking Iraq. I think that the U.S. hopes to weaken Iraq to such an extent that its military infrastructure would totally collapse and probably bring about the collapse of the regime itself. Hence, the U.S. would be in a better position to apply the other component of dual containment vis-a-vis Iran. And this is really all calculated to produce an image of a resolute U.S. so that no oppositional groups, either domestic or state opposition, say Syria and so on, to the kind of peace which Netanyahu is pursuing with Israel, which is really no peace, sort of a surrender, that I think would put the U.S. and Israel in a position to effect a diktat. I think that's the long-term objective of U.S. policy.
Daniel Pipes, what do you think of Dr. Arouri's assessment?
I think it's pretty wild. Let's start with 5 years ago when we had over 500,000 troops in the Persian Gulf. If we were seeking to have a diktat, hegemony, dominate the region, prevent anyone from disagreeing with us, we would have kept those troops there. We were without the opposition of the Soviet Union at that point. We had 500,000 troops, an immense arsenal in the Middle East. And you know what? As soon as the war ended against Iraq, we brought virtually all of them home. There are only 23,000 troops left. We're not interested in hegemony in the Middle East. We're cutting our military budget. We are uninterested in international affairs. We're interested in health care and taxes and matters like that. When, however, we face a direct challenge to our national interests, and by the way, anything having to do with the Persian Gulf, because of the immense amount of oil there, is of direct interest to us. When something like that happens, we act. But the notion that we're interested in hegemony in the Middle East or any place else is absolute nonsense.
I want to bring a third person into this conversation. We've just been joined in the studio by Sarah Lee Whitson, and she is general counsel for the Center for Economic and Social Rights. People may, if you saw the 60 Minutes program a couple months ago, remember that the center brought 60 Minutes to Iraq to look at the effects of sanctions there. But Sarah Lee has been there a number of times, and most recently there this past spring, looking at the situation in Kurdistan. Do you think it's just nonsense, ridiculous, Sarah Lee?
I think there's a lot of nonsense going on, but I'm not sure the nonsense comes from the U.S. wanting or not wanting hegemony in the region. I'm not even sure how to describe U.S. policy right now in Iraq. In fact, I think, sadly, there's no policy other than containing Iraq indefinitely with no uncertain future. Basically, the U.S. doesn't have a policy to create peace in the region, but the U.S. has a policy that anytime Saddam moves his troops or something like that, we drop several bombs on the region.
Sarah Lee, you have worked with Kurds for many years now. What do you think of the rationale that the United States was protecting the Kurds with Saddam Hussein moving into northern Iraq, although it is all a part of Iraq?
Protecting the Kurds, that I don't think many Kurds you'd find agreeing with, whether PUK or KDP. I feel that they have little trust or faith in the United States willing to protect them or wishing to protect them. If the United States had wanted to protect the Kurds, they could have done so perhaps in the last several years by seriously working on a negotiated settlement to the long-lasting conflict and precarious situation of the Kurds in the region. They have abandoned the Kurds, in fact, and if you'll note, all of Clinton's statements say nothing about the Kurds. They say that the air missile strikes have been to prevent and stop Iraq from threatening its neighbors. Of course, the Kurds are within their own country, and so they're not referring to the Kurds. And if you'll note that Clinton's attacks were all in southern Iraq and southern Iraqi military installations, and not at any place where the Kurds and the Iraqis may have been fighting. We really don't want an independent Kurdish state, and the State Department has made clear in no uncertain terms that they support the territorial integrity of Iraq. Somebody could tell me what it is that the United States wants. We're not allowing Saddam to move his troops in the country and to assert territorial sovereignty over the country, however brutal and unsavory we find his means to be, yet we don't want the Kurds to organize and, in fact, form some sort of viable autonomous state. And so we have this situation of chaos and complete void.
Daniel Pipes of Middle East Journal, could you offer an explanation? Do you think the U.S. has gone in to protect the Kurds?
Yeah, I think I can. By the way, it's Middle East Quarterly, not Middle East Journal. I think the the inconsistency that we just heard described is due to the fact that the U.S. government is not paying a whole lot of attention to Iraq or to foreign policy more generally. Our focus, as I said before, is domestic. She's right to say that the focus is not human rights, it's not Kurds, it's not protecting people. It is the maintenance of a containment policy against Iraq. We're trying to keep the Iraqi government from moving out of its box. We're not going so far as to try and eliminate it. We're just trying to contain it. That's the formal name of the policy. It is, in fact, what we're doing. When Saddam does something that goes outside of the box, we slap him down. I'm in agreement that it's not the best of all policies. It's a kind of absent-minded policy, but it's not a terribly bad one. It is, given our lack of interest in Iraq and the Persian Gulf more generally, it is a satisfactory one, though not a great one.
I just have to say that we had to lose Dr. Aruri because we had a bad phone line that was mixing up between the two lines. But we are talking to Daniel Pipes from Philadelphia, who is the editor of the Middle East Quarterly. And we're joined in our studio by Sarah Lee Whitson, who's general counsel for the Center for Economic and Social Rights.
Well, I'm glad Mr. Pipes and I both agree that and understand that the U.S. foreign policy in Iraq right now has nothing to do with human rights, has nothing to do with protecting lives of people who've become enmeshed in the international intrigue of national interests and oil interests. Unfortunately, though, I don't agree with Mr. Pipes when he says that, well, it's not such a bad policy, our policy of putting Saddam in a box. In fact, I think it's an inhumane one, one that's had a great toll on the civilians in Iraq. The sort of absent-minded, as Mr. Pipes called it, policy in Iraq over the last 5 years of imposing broad, over far-reaching sanctions have deprived over 100,000 Iraqi children of their lives.
No, we haven't deprived them. Saddam has. You know perfectly well that we've made available to him all sorts of export of oil as long as he agrees to certain conditions, and he hasn't done it. Why are you blaming us? Why don't you blame him?
Certain conditions, well, one could sit here and debate what those certain conditions were. In
fact, are you blaming, Americans or Saddam Hussein?
What I'm blaming is the absent-minded, unfocused, unthought-through policy of imposing sanctions on a country with ill-defined ends and goals.
I agree with you. It could be better. I agree with you that the most desirable thing, at least what you're implying, would have been to go in 6 years ago and extirpate Saddam Hussein and his regime. But I submit to you and to everyone else who's listening that the American people were not ready then and are not ready now to take the casualties and the heartaches and headaches that go with bringing in a new regime in Iraq. And therefore, we're doing something much more modest, which is to contain the regime. And I agree with you. It's not as good as it should be. But insofar as people are suffering now, don't blame us for it.
I guess I have a problem blaming anyone else or anywhere else.
What about
United
Saddam?
States, when the United States was the last remaining, perhaps with the UK, the last remaining force in the UN that supported sanctions, despite the UN's well-documented and the center's well-documented evidence showing that these sanctions had no effect on the Saddam regime, in fact, by limiting the population's access and control to supplies because of sanctions, there was no resource for the people other than what the government would provide them in Iraq. And I think I'm not sure that I agree that the U.S. policy of depriving food, or rather access to food and medicines, which was the first, in fact, in place economic sanctions policy until some members of the U.N. Security Council opposed that. That policy, I hardly think represents, in fact, an okay, it's the best we can do policy.
I find it very strange that you're outraged only at the U.S. government. I hear outrage against Saddam.
Oh, I have a lot of outrage against Saddam.
Well, let's start with that.
Well,
I mean,
he is
the first malefactor. And then you can criticize American policy for not coping adequately with this evil regime. Okay, I agree. It's not as good as it should be. But the ultimate problem lies not in Washington, but in Baghdad, right?
Well, I guess you can add to that list of heinous offenders of human rights, then, the Turkish government, which has probably killed far many more Kurds. Far more human rights studies document the atrocities of the Turkish government with U.S. weapons, U.S. copters
How come the Kurds flee from Iraq to Turkey by the millions?
Well, let's put that question.
It's so terrible and Turkey. How come they're fleeing?
Where should they flee to in Turkey?
Let me interrupt for 1 second. Sarah Lee Whitson, General Counsel for Center for Economic Social Rights. Daniel Pipes, editor of the Middle East Quarterly. And we have been rejoined by Dr. Nasser Arouri, professor of political science at University of Massachusetts, who I think has something he'd like to say about why Kurds do try to leave Turkey and the human rights record of the Turkish government.
Well, I think that the human rights record of the Turkish government is atrocious, and that this has been documented by most human rights organizations that really have a standing in the world, including Amnesty International, Middle East Watch, and the others. And not only did the Clinton administration say nothing about these violations, but it also, by assisting Iraq and the fact that by assisting Turkey, and the fact that Turkey is a U.S. ally, I think it makes it really easier for Turkey to suppress the Kurdish insurgency and their demand mainly for autonomy. I mean, their demands are not really extravagant. There are 27 million Kurds in that area. And what they want is some sort of a decent life, some sort of autonomy in all these areas.
But Daniel Pipes has asked,
has anything to do with the human rights of the Kurds. And it is, after all, the military activities are in the south and not in the north.
But Dr. Rory, Daniel Pipes has asked, why do Kurds leave Turkey and go into Iraq if the situation is worse?
Other way around. Why do they leave Iraq for Turkey?
Why do they go into Turkey if the situation is worse?
Well, you see, I'm not claiming that the record of human rights of the Iraqi government is better than that of Turkey. So, I mean, obviously there are state interests as interpreted by the Iraqi government, just as there are state interests seen by the Turkish government. And the Kurds are not really a monolithic movement. So there are factions of the Kurds. And therefore, in pursuing their interests, they find themselves, these factions, allied with Iran, sometimes allied with Turkey, sometimes allied with Iraq. And hence the movement among these Kurdish groups into that. I mean, it does not really mean that they are fleeing Iraq to Turkey, that Turkey is a safe haven. On the contrary,
it is
really hell for them to be in Turkey, just as it is to be in Iraq and Iran.
Well, if it's hell, why do they go there?
Well, I'll tell you why they go there. It's so sad. It's so sad that the Kurds in Turkey have nowhere to flee and nowhere to go to. Look in Germany, look in Sweden. You'll find as many Kurds there as you can find fleeing from Turkey, fleeing
the
oppression.
Of course, there are problems with Turkey.
Unfortunately, they have nowhere to go to escape from the barbarity and cruelty of the Turkish government.
They can go to Germany.
They can't go to Germany in enough numbers as they'd like.
Look, I completely agree with both of your premises, which is that all governments are flawed. This government makes mistakes. The Turkish government has its sins, no question. But how can you compare the Turkish and American governments on the one hand and the Iraqi on the other hand?
Because human rights...
Let me finish. In the case of Iraq, you're dealing with one of the most brutal, totalitarian, evil regimes on the face of the earth that is completely in the command of a single person. The whole country is being recreated in order to fit his psychological needs. And hundreds of thousands, millions of people have died as a result
of this. Well, that is very true,
and
but that's
so
not
let's
unique,
concentrate
really. It is true, but it's not unique.
Let me just finish.
One at a time, Dr. Arouri.
I wanted to say something about it.
Dr. Arouri, your response.
Sorry, yes. Yes, I mean, it is one thing to talk about the situation in Iraq that is dictatorial, totalitarian, et cetera, et cetera. It's another thing really to talk about the demonization of Saddam Hussein as if the 17 million Iraqis are all Saddam Hussein. I mean, these strikes are inflicting severe damage on 17 million Iraqis. These sanctions have taken a toll. I mean, more than 500,000 Iraqi children have perished as a result of these things. It is not Saddam Hussein, you see. It is really Iraqi people who are suffering.
Of course they're suffering, but who's to blame? Us or Saddam?
Mr. Pipes,
of course, it's U.S. policy because the United States has really hijacked
no
the United
blame
Nations.
To Saddam.
But
Mr.
this time
Pipes?
It did not even bother to seek United Nations approval for its action.
Iraqi children are suffering 100% because of us.
Mr. Pipes, you keep raising the specter of why do we blame the United States. This is not just a matter of finger-pointing and blaming, okay? We're sitting here saying, who's worse? You know, is the government of Turkey worse in massacring Kurds, or is Iraq worse? Just 1 second, I just want to get to the point. There are laws, there are international laws, as weak and vague as they may be, that actually govern the force with which international actors and international forces may act. There are laws that say that you cannot inflict any sort of punishment that you want on a government that, let's say, a leader, a dictator who's as atrocious and as demonized. Hold on 1 second. Who's as evil and demonized as Saddam is. You know, let's all just agree that he is very bad. In fact, one of the worst, if not the worst. We can sit there and agree on that. That does not justify an arbitrary policy of 5.5 years of sanctions that punished only the civilians of Iraq. That has nothing to do with punishing Saddam. And of course, I can blame the United States. I'm a U.S. citizen. I have a right to criticize the policies of this country that cause harm and aid to others. Just the fact that it's, well, it may be the best that we have, that's not good enough for the American people.
All right. Look, I can agree with you that we should do better. But I would like to get a premise on the table that you've just established. I'd like Professor Ruhi to agree with it.
I mean,
that the Saddam regime is among the worst in the world, and that the source of evil comes from there, not from Washington or from Turkey.
No, I don't really agree. I think that the source of evil really is coming from Washington, which keeps inflicting this severe damage. And I think that it borders on the genocide.
On that note, I hate to say, but on that note, we are going to have to wrap up. But I do want to get two phone numbers. One is the Center for Economic and Social Rights, which has put out a report on what the sanctions have done in Iraq. And I also want to get the Middle East Quarterly's number. Sarah Lee Whitson, your number.
The center's phone number is 212-982-1950.
One more time.
212-982-1950.
And Daniel Pipes, the number of the Middle East Quarterly.
We're in Philadelphia at 215-569-9225.
That's 215-569-9225. And I'm sorry we couldn't carry this discussion a little further, but it's one that we will carry on in the coming weeks, I'm sure. We've been talking to Daniel Pipes, editor of the Middle East Quarterly, based in Philadelphia, Sarah Lee Whitson, general counsel for the Center for Economic and Social Rights, based here in New York City, and we've been talking to Professor Nasser Arouri, professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. This is Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio's daily grassroots election show. I'm Amy Goodman. This week, millions of children pack their knapsacks and their lunches and headed back to school. This week on Democracy Now!, we're bringing you a series of reports on the state of public education, an issue which many agree should be central in this year's political campaigns. Public school districts across the country are finding their resources drying up as a direct result of shrinking tax bases and property tax limitation measures. In part two of her series, Carefully Taught, producer Barbara Bernstein contrasts two school districts, Portland, Oregon, and Milwaukee, Wisconsin, which are taking decidedly different paths to deal with the funding crisis in public education.
The public school system is a monopoly, and there are no consequences for failure and few rewards for success. The dollars and the kids keep coming no matter what.
We don't need more money in education. We need to look at more efficient ways of using it, one of which would be perhaps looking at privatization of some services.
Well, what if public schools had even more money? I can't imagine how that would have any positive effect.
Susan Mitchell, Natalie Williams, and Michael Joyce are leading strategists for the privatization of public education, what many progressives are calling the dismantling of public education. During the 1960s and early 70s, funding for public education grew enormously. Large infusions of federal aid, especially during the Johnson administration, funded all sorts of innovative programs in local school districts. Since the Reagan era, conservatives have tried to cut back both federal financing and federal influence on public education. Now, in an era of shrinking tax bases and spiraling costs, the financial future of public education is more uncertain than ever. Years ago, many people would have taken for granted in a school in the city or in the suburbs that there would be art and there would be libraries and there would be athletics, music. You would take for granted there would be enough textbooks for people to go around. Holly Sklar is author of Chaos or Community and other critiques of social and economic injustice in the United States. As the urban school system became more and more a school system of children of color and less a school system of whites, and the people who were passing things like the property tax measures made it impossible to raise taxes, you allowed the school system to be defunded to such a degree that you had a situation where art classes were eliminated as luxuries, music was eliminated as luxuries, language eliminated as luxuries. Now, a lot of schools don't have libraries. Schools literally don't have toilet paper. Schools literally don't have enough paper, pencils, pens. Schools don't certainly have enough textbooks to go around.
Part of the attack on public education, and indeed the attack on all public institutions, is rooted in the tax revolt that swept America over the last few years.
The tax revolt, referred to by researcher Chip Berlay, began in California in 1978 with the passage of Proposition 13, the first of many property tax limitation measures enacted in states all across the country. California had had one of the finest public school systems in the world, but after Proposition 13, its spending per student plummeted, and the state's exemplary education system began to unravel. Just to the north in Oregon, it took five attempts for a property tax limitation initiative to finally pass in 1990. It was called Measure 5. Michael Sweeney teaches history and social studies at Lincoln High School in Portland, Oregon.
This is one of the last best urban school systems in the United States. A great deal of it had to do with funding, that up until Measure 5, there was a big measure of local control. That, of course, created problems of equity. But at least in Portland, the citizens never seemed really reluctant to fund education, and they paid heavy property taxes for a school system that relatively speaking, did a very good job at taking care of their children.
After 5 years of annually shrinking revenues and administrative cutbacks, the Portland public school system finally found itself forced to make cuts at the classroom level.
At my school, for instance, our total staff will be reduced by 1/8. We can just barely hold the line with not just the academic challenges, but the social and psychological challenges and emotional challenges kids bring us with the number of people we had last year. So this coming year is going to be like triage. Kids that you know, because of overwhelming numbers, you're just simply not going to be able to get to. And that's where the tragedy becomes real in the classroom.
When I first heard, when I was about in fifth grade, and I heard that we didn't have enough money for books, I just laughed.
Erin Suris and Joe Link is a student of Michael Sweeney's.
I was like, that's ridiculous. School is important, you know. They're making TV shows for millions of dollars. What do you mean we don't have any money?
Towards the end of the 1996 school year, public education supporters had one last resort. They took to the streets. And on June 1st, over 35,000 people marched through Portland, demanding that the political and business leadership of the state listen to their concerns.
I think the march in some ways was a symbol of the lack of power of people who support public education. Every effort to find more satisfactory and more equitable solutions to the funding problem in the state had been tried and had failed.
Doug Sherman trains aspiring teachers at Portland State University.
The larger message that students have gotten is that people don't care enough about them and their lives to adequately fund schools, that teachers that they care about and that care about them are losing their jobs or having many more students in their classes. And I think that the message that they've been getting for a long time is that they're not valued and that their futures aren't valued. The message from the march is at least there are adults around willing to organize this to fight back. That's a lot healthier than seeing themselves just as victims of it.
Denying the funds that different states and agencies and groups need to actually function is part of the devolution that we see, and in a return to the earlier form of society where you don't have public education and you don't have public welfare and you go back to charity and private schools and sort of rolling back the clock before the Roosevelt era.
Researcher Chip Berlay.
It's a very intentional part of the process to deny tax funds and to create situations where institutions can only fail because they lack the resources.
Unlike in Portland, the public school system in Milwaukee, Wisconsin has been in crisis for years, and now the majority of middle-class families there send their children to private schools. A few years ago, a coalition of business leaders, politicians, and low-income parents came up with a plan to provide vouchers for low-income families to pay for private school tuition. The coalition received significant support from the Bradley Foundation, the nation's leading funder of conservative research and publications. Michael Joyce is the president of the Bradley Foundation.
These center city schools have become stockpiles for low-income people who have very little to say about the kind of education, even the school where their child will go.
Remember that people who have choices in Milwaukee have already exercised them. They've either moved to the suburbs or they put their kids into private schools, and the people who have choices are the people who have money.
Susan Mitchell of the Mitchell Company has worked with a coalition of business leaders to expand Milwaukee's limited school voucher program.
The kids in the Milwaukee public schools are mostly poor, mostly minority kids who do not have options and whose parents want, in large numbers, something different for their kids. So to deny these children the choice is to deny the very people that the critics profess to worry about.
Milwaukee's Parents' Choice Program provides vouchers to low-income families so they can send their children to private secular schools within the city limits.
The Milwaukee Parents' Choice Program, as it's presently constituted, is very unusual because it really is an affirmative action program limited to low-income students, and it has a number of safeguards and constraints that other voucher proposals don't have.
Robert Lowe is a co-editor of Rethinking Schools, which is published in Milwaukee.
The program has provided support to some long-term struggling community schools that have done a nice job with very scarce resources. What I think we have to understand, however, is that everywhere in the country, the Milwaukee program is looked at as an entering wedge in the larger debate around vouchers.
The Wisconsin legislature recently passed an expanded voucher plan that would also include parochial schools. Robert Lowe worries that the small-scale voucher plan will give way to vouchers for everyone. In the spirit of free enterprise, Michael Joyce of the Bradley Foundation thinks that a universal voucher system will improve education in the state.
Competition works. We know this from higher education. It's a very good thing indeed that in higher education we have a plethora of choices ranging from state universities all the way down to private religious colleges and all the rest. The competition tends to have a good effect on providers, particularly when they have to satisfy customers. In higher education, people are free to choose as they will. I don't see any reason why that shouldn't be the case with regard to elementary and secondary education.
Parental involvement in a voucher system is simply that of a customer who can participate to the extent that that customer can pay for a service.
Robert Lowe, Rethinking Schools.
If you view yourself as a consumer, your responsibility is only for maximizing your own interest. It's not for being concerned with other people's interests, other children's interests. In the public sector, on the other hand, there's a notion that people are not consumers so much as citizens, and that public schools are fundamental in order to carry out a democratic society. And I think that the ultimate trajectory of a voucher notion is that all services can be privatized, that we have no responsibility for other people's children, that we can have a society that's divided into little Warrens that are even more stratified by race and class than we have today.
So many of the people who have historically been my friends, we're on different sides on the question of choice.
Howard Fuller is a leader in the African American community in Milwaukee. He is the former superintendent of schools in Milwaukee and is currently a distinguished professor of education at Marquette University.
I mean, I understand all of the arguments about this will just be a way for the rich to get their foot in the door. Once they get their foot in the door, it'll be unlimited vouchers for everyone. It's a part of the whole idea of like destroying public education, destroying public anything. And I don't take those arguments lightly. I think that there are people out there who clearly have those agendas in mind. But I think, quite frankly, that the liberals and the progressives have for so long refused to deal fundamentally with this structure that does not work, that people are no longer willing to listen to these arguments. I frankly do not see a way to make the kinds of radical changes that are needed without empowering poor people, without giving them some capacity to make choices for their children, the same ones that people with money are making every day for their kids.
For Democracy Now!, this is Barbara Bernstein reporting.
Tomorrow on Democracy Now!, the battle over the teaching of American history. Barbara Bernstein's series, Carefully Taught, Clashing Values in the Classroom, will air as a two-hour documentary on alternative radio later this fall. Also tomorrow morning at sunrise, a New Jersey activist will begin a fast to protest education cuts, dubbed the Whitman Funding Plan. It's named for New Jersey Governor Christine Todd Whitman. Larry Hamm is head of the People's Organization for Progress and the New Jersey Million Man March Committee. He organized more than 13,000 men last October to go down for the march in Washington, D.C.
I'm going on this fast, and I'm asking other members of the community to join me to protest the historic and continuing inequality in public education here in New Jersey, and more immediately, also to protest the proposed cuts in school aid, which are contained in a school funding plan currently being considered by the state legislature.
Larry, what are the scope of the education cuts?
Well, these cuts are drastic in scope. Many of the state's largest and poorest urban districts will be hit by multi-million dollar cuts, and I'm talking about each district being hit with cuts ranging from a million to tens of millions of dollars. For instance, the city of Newark, which just had to let go and lay off more than 600 workers last month, would lose more than $30 million next school year in state aid, and that could only have a negative impact on the schools in these districts, and ultimately it's the kids who will really suffer.
Can you explain how these cuts fit into the precedent-setting decision of the state Supreme Court recently around education?
Well, several years ago, around 1990, the New Jersey State Supreme Court rendered a landmark ruling in the Abbott versus Burke case. To put it in a nutshell, the ruling recognized inherent inequality in the state's public school system, particularly the way the system of school funding was set up, and the state mandated that Jersey had to close the gap, had to equalize funding between the rich and poor school districts. I personally see that as one of the most significant rulings in education since Brown versus Topeka, Kansas, because whereas Brown said unequal schools was wrong, Abbott says not only is it wrong, but the state is responsible for funding its schools equally and providing the resources to repair past damages. And that's very significant. Now, initially, the state made steps to comply when Governor Florio was in office. The legislature passed the Quality Education Act, which took the first steps toward equalizing that funding. It didn't equalize it, but it took steps in that direction. However, it seems that this current school funding plan that's being considered for the next school year is actually moving in the opposite direction, moving in the wrong direction. And that's why I'm going on this fast, because the situation is so drastic that I personally felt I had to take some extraordinary action to draw attention to this extraordinary situation, because it doesn't just affect the Newark School District. It affects almost 25 or more major school districts throughout the state.
Do your children go to public school in New Jersey?
Yes, my children do attend public schools.
Larry, we have to break for 60 seconds, and then we'll be back with Larry Hamm, head of the People's Organization for Progress. After that, we'll be speaking with Winona LaDuc. She's the vice presidential candidate on the Green Party ticket. You're listening to Democracy Now. Stay with us. I'm Amy Goodman, and this is Democracy Now! We're continuing our conversation with Lawrence Hamm, head of the People's Organization for Progress based in New Jersey. Tomorrow morning at sunrise, he begins a fast against education cuts. Larry, I wanted to ask you about Governor Christine Todd Whitman. She is hailed as a national model with her tax cuts in New Jersey. Bob Dole is often talking about her when he talks about his 15% tax cut across the board. What is her involvement with the education cuts that are being considered by the New Jersey state legislature?
Well, to be frank, when you read the newspapers, many of them describe this school funding plan that's under consideration as the Whitman funding plan. So she's right in the center of all of this. Some feel that, in fact, her tax cuts have led to a shortfall in revenues, which may be one of the reasons why we have to cut back state aid to many of the schools. Now, that's the opinion of some. Others do not hold that opinion. But clearly, this seems to be Governor Whitman's spending plan.
Before you decided on this fast, did you and your organization, People's Organization for Progress, have you tried any other avenues to get the politicians to hear what you have to say?
Well, the People's Organization for Progress, for more than a decade, has been active in school-related, education-related issues. We had been involved in struggles together in coalition with other groups to change the Newark Board of Education, which is the largest school board organization in the state, to change it from an elected to appointed board. And that battle was successful back in the mid-80s. And then over the years, we've been active in fighting proposed cuts in school programs, both at the local levels and the state level, and opposing federal budget cuts. And we were supportive of the efforts around the Abbott versus Burke case. More recently, we've become part of a broader coalition, a statewide coalition called the Coalition for a True, Thorough, and Efficient Education. And through that, we have been trying to work with legislators in the area to come up with some alternative legislation to the legislation that currently contains the school funding program that's under consideration.
Has the gap between the rich and the poor schools grown? I mean, is that why you're beginning your fast this year rather than in the past?
Yes, I feel the bottom line is that the gap has grown. 25 years ago, a quarter of a century, I was appointed to the North Board of Education. The schools were unequal then, and the schools are even more unequal now. In fact, these kids have fewer opportunities to look forward to than I did when I graduated high school. In the early 70s, many of the social programs that came into existence during the 60s, they were still in existence and provided some help to many of us who were in high school then. Many of those programs are non-existent now. You know, a lot of these kids have fewer possibilities of attending college than I did back in 1971. So I feel, yes, the situation is worse. It's a crisis situation. In fact, to be truthful, what I see in place is a dynamic now. It's not just a problem. You know, it's a whole system that is enlarging the underclass. I mean, in many ways, it almost seems as if the system is now functioning in such a way, both the education system and the economic system, to produce a class of urban untouchables. You know, kids who come out of these high schools with no skills, with no opportunities, and inevitably many of them turn to crime and ultimately will go on to jail and become part of the permanent underclass. So it's a dire situation, and we have to take action, and we have to take drastic action. And the FAST is just, you know, one step. I'm prepared to go beyond that, and I know many other people are prepared to go beyond that. You know, we may begin to have to employ massive civil disobedience as was employed during the civil rights movement. I mean, that's what we might have to do up here in the urban north in order to get some redress to these dire social issues that we're faced with.
Larry Hamm, I want to thank you very much for joining us. Larry Hamm is head of the People's Organization for Progress. He holds a news conference today at 5 o'clock in Newark to announce the fast he will begin tomorrow morning at sunrise that will continue throughout September as he protests the proposed education cuts that are being considered before the New Jersey State Legislature. And you're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Green Party presidential candidate Ralph Nader now has a vice presidential running mate. Her name is Winona LaDuc, and she is a world-renowned environmentalist and native rights activist, a founder of the Indigenous Women's Network, who last year Time Magazine named one of 50 leaders for the future. So I guess Time Magazine got something right, Winona.
Sometimes we hope.
Well, why don't you, I think actually this fits perfectly coming out of Larry Hamm talking about education in New Jersey and around the country, to talk about what your platform is as you have just been named the vice presidential running mate of Ralph Nader on the Green Party ticket.
Well, I'm, of course, working closely with Ralph, and we have very similar views on a lot of issues, and our general campaign is pro-democracy and anti-corporate. basically saying that people of privilege should not be able to make the decisions for all of us in this country, and instead the people who are impacted by policy should also have a right to be part of those decisions. My views reflect that and are kind of in the broader sense, that it's really time for all of us to be much more enfranchised in the political process. And around that I have a number of issues. One of the most important, I think, is the idea of looking at a seventh generation or common property amendment to the U.S. Constitution. Basically saying that right now in this country one of the big issues is private property rights. And private property rights are, of course, recognized under the Fifth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. It's fundamental. But the preamble to the U.S. Constitution talks about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness to all of us and our posterity. And one of the problems we have in this country is that there's nothing to protect common property. The U.S. legal system needs to establish a clear distinction between private property and common property and defend both rigorously. So I'm looking at something like maybe an amendment to the Constitution that says that the rights of citizens to use and enjoy clean air, water, sunlight, and other renewable resources determined by Congress to be common property should not be impaired, nor such use be impaired for their availability for the use of future generations. That's one of the things I'm looking at, the idea of trying to preserve the commons for all of us, that private interests shouldn't have the right to pillage the commons.
Especially in this day and age, and a very odd notion, at least certainly out of place inside the Beltway in Washington, D.C.
That's exactly right. But it's my view that those things need to be talked about. I mean, right now public policy is defined largely within the Beltway, but those of us impacted, I come from Indian Reservation in northern Minnesota where half the people live below the poverty level. Welfare reform, how's that affect us? Pretty drastically. You know, let me try to figure out what my community's supposed to do when you got to drive like 60 miles for a job up here, which is usually off-reservation, and you're going to get paid minimum wage. So you could have two people working for $6 or $5 an hour, driving 60, miles to go get their job, and by the time they get done paying their child care expenses, they're still the working poor. You understand what I'm saying?
Oh, I think a lot of people understand what you're saying.
Yeah, so I'm looking at, for instance, in terms of welfare reform, I'm tired of hearing the blaming of the victim. How about talking about really addressing the issues of structural poverty? The fact that, today the top 1% of the population controls more wealth than the bottom 90%, and the problem's grown worse. In 76, 19% of private wealth was held by the top 1%. Today the figure is 40%. What we need is bottom-up economics, where we talk about public and private revitalization of local communities, reinvestment, mandates for nonprofit, private, and public sectors in both urban and rural areas. A lot of people forget the rural areas. That's where I live. Funding for microenterprise loan programs, capitalization of local infrastructure, and programs. The last person on your show was talking about education. Programs to stop the brain drain from rural communities and from communities of color, which goes on, where, you get these people that get educated in our communities, they leave to get a good job someplace because that's affirmative action and that's what all that hiring is about. We also need to be able to keep our people in our communities, so we need to kind of invest in enough infrastructure to keep them. So those are some of the issues that we're looking at. It's kind of the long-term structural issues. And issues that aren't largely discussed by the two parties or, if you want to call it three parties that are out there.
If you want to call it three, some people wonder if there are even two. We're talking to Winona LaDuke, an Ojibwe activist from the White Earth Reservation, northern Minnesota, and she has joined Green Party presidential candidate Ralph Nader in his challenge to the two-party duopoly, as he likes to call it. Now, let me ask you, since the announcement that you are the vice presidential candidate on the Green Party ticket last Thursday, have you gotten calls from the mainstream press to interview you?
I haven't gotten calls from the mainstream press. I guess it was picked up by the wire service. I've done some work with NPR, and I'm doing a local press conference. I live in how you describe it, kind of like Northern California, really far Northern California, like around, Mount Shasta or something. I live in a real rural area like that. And so we're doing a press conference today for the local press to give them an opportunity to talk about some of the issues. And I think there's going to be some radio and some TV there.
Is there any possibility that you might participate in the debates? Now, I know that when Ralph Nader came to crash the Democratic Party convention, he bumped into Haley Barbour.
And Haley Barbour said that he is calling for Nader to be included in the debates that are coming up, this supposedly three presidential debates. Now, if he were included, that would have to mean you'd be included in the vice presidential debates. Is there any talk of that?
Yes, there is some talk of that. I mean, we'll be looking at that. Right now, we're looking at being on the ballot in 29 states, and you can vote for us in 44 states.
What does that mean, to be on the ballot versus you can vote for you?
You can write us in 44 states, but in the remainder between the 29 and the 44. But in those other states, you can actually vote for us. We're on the ballot. And so we consider ourselves viable candidates. We're also looking at kind of the long-term process, because if you actually want to build a multi-party system in this country, you have to start somewhere. And as you know, and probably a lot of other people know, the Green Party is active in 72 countries in the world and is quite prominent in many European countries. We believe in the principles of the Green Party, and it is our hope that through the process of beginning to build this year, this is the first time that we've fielded a national candidate and been on the ballot in so many states, that over the next few years and few elections, we will in fact begin building a multi-party system, or one that is reflective of the broader views of the people who are disenfranchised, the people who are affected by public policy, not the people of privilege in this country.
Winona LaDuke, what is the reaction of your neighbors on the White Earth Reservation to you participating in this process in the United States that has come to be so removed from anything, certainly, that Native Americans are involved with, or actually probably doesn't represent something very good for them?
Well, there's, you know, first of all, I live with both Indians and non-Indians on my reservation. That's one of the things up here. I went out as a matter of principle and got my neighbors all, asked them if they'd all sign, if I had a right to be on the ballot, and there was pretty widespread support up here, I'd say, for that. One older man, I talked to him, and he wasn't exactly sure who was president right now, but he said he'd vote for me for vice president. He thought that'd be good. So that's kind of an indicator maybe of, like, how far away we are from some of those things. Someone else yesterday asked me vice president of what. It's kind of a broad spectrum. But I think it's important to question the idea. I mean, does a person like myself, who lives in a rural area on a reservation, have views that are valid for broader public policy? Or do I have a right to say what I believe? I mean, do I have a right to participate in a national political debate? And, by and large, my community, and by and large, what I am saying is yes. I'm saying that, I may be what's called a Native American activist up here on this reservation in northern Minnesota, but the fact is that public policy affects me. And as a parent, I wonder why I should be more concerned about the amount of sugar in my son's breakfast cereal than the amount of mercury he's accumulating in his body from eating fish from northern Minnesota lakes that have mercury in them. I'm as a parent, as a person who participates in this society, I think that I have views that are reflective of the broader interests of this country as well.
What about your views on the Department of Interior, which has for so long overseen the affairs of Native American people in this country?
Well, it's totally ironic. This country, first of all, Indians were in the Department of War, and now we've moved over to Department of Interior, and we're treated largely as natural resources. So when they do budget cuts in Interior, Indians are literally in there fighting it out with ducks and Department of Mines for, like, our little piece of the crumbs that are inside Interior. I think that Indian people should be treated as human beings with full human rights. The problem is that the U.S. State Department is right now, and the U.S. government's policy internationally is that they do not recognize the rights of indigenous peoples. They don't recognize us as peoples under the law. And under international law, if you're peoples, you have rights to self-determination. You have rights to your territory, rights to your land, rights to determine your destiny, rights to your language, rights to your culture, rights to control your economy. Under international law, the U.S. State Department does not recognize us as peoples. Kind of ironic in a country that touts an international human rights record. I would like to be treated as a people. I would like to be treated as a person and accorded full human rights in this society. And so my view is that if the poorest people in this country, which are Indians, Indian people, if the poorest people in this country can't have justice, I really can't say that we can say we have justice in this country.
Winona LaDuke, last question. Since you're a vice presidential candidate, will you release your tax returns? I know Ralph Nader has said no, he won't, although he's not going above the $5,000 limit.
Yeah, that's exactly the same position I have. We're spending less than $5,000 on our campaign, which basically, you know, is what the Republicans spent on their balloons for the Republican convention.
I would guess it was more than that.
Yeah, you know, handling and ascension and descension, you know, and I'm keeping with Ralph in that. I mean, if Ralph isn't, I'm not either, because that's the way that the law is. But, you know, basically the truth is that I don't got anything in my closet, and everybody's in my house already. You know, I have a house full of people all the time up here, and pretty much everybody on this reservation knows everything there is about me. And if you want to ask about me, come up here and go ask at the local store.
Well, Winona LaDuke, I want to thank you very much for joining us. Winona LaDuke is the vice presidential running mate of Ralph Nader on the Green Party ticket, speaking to us from the White Earth Reservation in northern Minnesota. By the way, the phone number, if you want to find out about the Green Party, the phone number you can call is 888-NADER-96. That's 888-NADER-96. Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin, help from Errol Maitland, Brother Shine, Janice K. Bryant. I'm Amy Goodman. If you'd like a copy of today's show, 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Thanks for listening.